Good morning, Spokane. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. The show is Praxis. My name's Taylor, and today I'll be joined live on the air over the phone with Jason Baldwin, one of the West Memphis Three, so-called. And you might know something about this case if you went to the free documentary screening at the Magic Lantern last week of Paradise Lost, the first film in a series of three about this case. Jason, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right, and we can hear you in here. You're on the air. How are you doing this
morning? Oh, great. I'm doing very well this morning. Thank you very much.
All right. So for those who aren't familiar with this case, I'm just going to give a quick overview of the series of events that led to the wrongful prosecution of three young men in West Memphis, something that happens all too frequently in our justice system. And basically what happened in West Memphis was three 8-year-old boys were brutally murdered and dumped in a wild area of the town called Robin Hood Hills. And the investigation, it emerged later that the investigation had a number of flaws, from the police handling of evidence to the insufficient questioning of neighbors and people involved who ended up having information later on down the road that was never shared. And long story short, the blame ended up being pinned on you, Jason. Your best friend, Damian Eccles, was kind of the main accused, and Jesse Miskelly, who was a third friend who was coerced by police into giving a false confession. He was interrogated for 2 hours unrecorded before the recording of his confession was made. The content of those 2 hours before was never really elucidated in trial, at least not that I saw in the documentaries and any of the reading that I did.
It was about 12 hours, but yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's a lot more than two. And these boys, something to keep in mind with this whole case is that you all were 17 and 18?
Yeah, I was 16. I was the youngest. Jesse was 17, and Damian had just turned 18.
So Jesse confesses, and then the two of you, Damian and Jason, had a separate trial during which there was no physical evidence tying any of you to the crime. And there wasn't really any circumstantial evidence either. I think one person testified to having seen you nearby within a few hours, but many people would have been seen then. And the case ended up focusing on really a lot of personal decisions about the two of your lives and things about your lifestyles that were kind of criminalized during the trial. The murders, because of some mutilation to the victims, and what I found was a pretty common trend in the late 80s and early 90s, satanic cults were blamed as a kind of a scapegoat for this. They said it had the markings of a cult ritual, and who would be in a cult in this community but the only kids who listen to Metallica. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but basically the trial focused largely on the fact that Damian almost entirely.
Correct.
And he testified in court, and it focused on his brief interest in Wicca as a religion, which he said in the trial, you know, is actually about earth worship. I'm not a devil worshiper. He maintained that, but basically his beliefs were oversimplified, and the fact that you both listened to heavy metal music and occasionally participated in minor acts of vandalism related to promoting Metallica around your town, I believe, really turned this case into, that's really what the case was built on. And the jury ended up convicting both of you of first degree murder and sentencing Damian to the death penalty, again with no physical evidence, and to you with life in prison without the possibility of parole. Is that all pretty correct?
Yeah, that's the Reader's Digest version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We could spend a long time. But there are a great series of documentaries put out by HBO called Paradise Lost, Part 1, 2, and 3. They came out in 1996, 2000, and 2011, respectively. I just watched the third one, which was nominated for an Academy Award this last year.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm, I did. And
I just watched it again as well because, I saw it when it first came out. Some friends smuggled it into the prison as a kind act of humanity, a gesture of humanity. You know, they figured, you know, documentary coming out about my case, I need to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched it then, but that was years and years ago. So since I've been released. I just watched it again a few weeks ago, preparing myself for the second one. And of course, I saw the third one as it was released. Now I'm up, got to premiere it in Joe and Bruce's offices at Radical Media, you know, before it was even released, just to, you know, make sure everything was cool with it and everything. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that those did a good job covering your case?
Oh yeah, you know, it's difficult to you know, capture every single moment that's important and put it in, you know, just a couple, edit it down to a couple of hours of film. I think they had around 30,000 to 40,000 or more hours of film to edit through.
Wow.
And you know, so it is very condensed, but they did a wonderful job of, you know, capturing, you know, the spirit of what was going on. And you know, I sincerely believe it, just as Damien says, and one of them, I get them all mixed up, that, you know, had it not been for Bruce and Joe being there, had it not been for Sheila Nevins, you know, spotting a little article in the New York Times about what had happened, and then recording it, you know, forever on tape, then, you know, we'd have been forgotten and never had any support, and Damien would have been murdered by the state, and Jesse and I would still be there, you know, languishing, mm-hmm. and, you know, Stevie and Chris and Michael's families would, you know, never have hope of finding who really murdered their kids.
Mm-hmm. And that leads into the real killer has still not been found in this case. And you all spent, you know, the last 18 years, 18 of the last 19 years appealing your case at the district court level.
Right. Yeah.
And unfortunately,
over 50% of my life there.
Wow, that's pretty mind blowing. And
right.
It was with
there came a point where I had more memories of being in prison than I did of being free. Because you got to think, you know, how much of your earliest years can you remember, you know, like 1 through 4 or whatnot. So, yeah, the greater portion of my life was prison. My girlfriend jokes with me all the time. She'll be like, she's got sort of a dark sense of humor. She'll be like, what were you, raised in prison? As opposed to, you know, what were you mm-hmm. born in a barn? Close that door or whatever, you know.
Oh, man. Well, so you finally were freed based on a pretty bizarre legal maneuver that I had never heard of, called an Alford plea. Can you explain what that is and how it worked in your case?
It's basically where there's a stalemate between, you know, the defendants and the state. The defendants are innocent and, you know, continue to maintain their innocence. The state don't want to admit the mistake of having convicted an innocent person in prison and won't budge. So you have a great lengthy process ahead of, you know, that's going to cost, you know, both sides and probably an insurmountable X amount of dollars. And what it does is really it's a gift to the state, you know, by saying, hey, you know, if you catch me, I'm in this burning building. If you'll go ahead and catch me, let me jump out this burning building and catch me, you know, I won't sue you for wrongful conviction and all of those things, and the state won't have to bear the burden of you know, new trials and whatnot. So, but it permits us to say, you know, we're innocent, but if you'll let us out now, you know, we won't take you to retrial and we won't sue you for wrongful imprisonment. That's the gist of it.
Okay, so you won't receive any reparations from the state of Arkansas for what happened?
No.
Because
no.
of that plea?
And honestly, I didn't want to take the Alford plea. I've said this on numerous occasions. I did not want to take the Alford plea. You know, if you compare and contrast my initial arrest and first going into prison, you know, everybody thought I was guilty, thought Damien was guilty, thought Jesse was guilty. They were, you know, just waiting on us to get to prison and do us harm because, you know, we were convicted of the worst things imaginable, you know, killing kids in a horrible way. So, you know, on, you know, arrival in prison, you know, they're like, ah, that's the guy we're waiting on. So, you know, I've got bones broken, skull shattered. You know, first couple of years, you know, I couldn't count the number of fights I've been in, you know, but you compare that to the day I was released, prison was literally in tears, you know, tears of joy that I was going home. They'd grown to love me, respect me, and believe in my innocence, prayed and cried for me, and you know, so those beatings and curses turned into hugs and prayers. So, you know, I had a job and a life there. So prison, though it was a place I did not deserve to be for one second, you know, I'd built a life there, you know, I'd built a life. So I was willing to, you know, stay there, you know, as long as it took to, you know, fight the good fight and, you know, win a new trial or whatever it took, you know, to open the case back up. So, you know, so the state would, you know, have the books open on it so the pursuit of the real killers can be done. But I couldn't do that to Jesse and Damien. You know, they're in a different situation. Damien, he's on death row, and he doesn't get to do anything but sit in a cell, you know, and languish. I mean, his health was failing miserably. You know, after we were released, you know, I had confirmation that what I did was really the right thing, because we had, just maybe within a month of our release, we were in New York, and we were visiting the Museum of Natural History. And Damien is a young man. He's only a couple of years older than I am. He was like 37. And every 5 minutes, he would literally have to stop and sit down and catch his breath just from walking in the museum every 5 minutes. And, I mean, that tells me a lot, you know, poor guy, you know. So, and then on the same token, too, Jesse's father came and visited him every single weekend of the 18 years until the last year. His health did a complete 180. So I imagine Jesse's like, you know, what if I never get to see my dad again if I get out? What if he never gets to see me as a free man? Damien's mother is now in a wheelchair and on oxygen. She just had a stroke. So I imagine the same thoughts were running through their heads. And my own mother, you know, her health hasn't been great either. You know, grief of this magnitude that just continues, you know, of knowing your son is innocent and needing them to be free and fighting as hard as you can, that takes a toll on a person. So all of these things, you know, I had to consider, you know, not just me being willing to fight, but what would continuing the fight do to these people? So, you know, I had to do the right thing, and just it wasn't the best deal. The state should have done better than that, should have just dropped the charges and opened the case back up and freed us. That would have freed them from, you know, continuing costs of hearings and a trial and whatnot. And we could have reached some type of agreement, like the state of Texas has a fund for their wrongfully convicted inmates. You know, I think they give them, if the innocent person agrees not to sue, they give them like an X amount of dollars for every year that they're in there, school, lodging and things like that, and, you know, take care of them without the cost of, you know, wrongful imprisonment too.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at some stats on the InnocenceProject.org, which kind of keeps facts on people specifically who have been exonerated from death row. And it says that about 60% of states financially compensate those who are exonerated through DNA testing. And that's not exactly right. What happened to you all, but I think it probably could have.
They know we're innocent. And they know we would have proved that, and we just went home, and just instead of, you know, doing the right thing, they chose the way, you know, to save themselves money. But they did it at the cost of justice, and I personally can bear that burden. I've been bearing it for the majority of my life. But how can you say that to Pam Hobbs, you know, that her son was murdered and the state's not going to do anything to find who killed the kid, you know, and mm-hmm. the other boy. I mean, that's a horrible, horrible thing. Justice should not be for sale like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. And she's been very persistent. I thought that her story was pretty interesting. She's one of the mothers of one of the victims, if you hadn't heard that. And her former husband was also a suspect for a while after your trial, after you had already been convicted. A small amount of DNA tied him to the crime, really making him putting more evidence to convict him than there ever was to convict you.
Well, yeah, that's correct. But for me, it's a hard, after being what I've been through, perhaps I'm a bit traumatized, but it's difficult for me to point the finger of suspicion at anybody. The only thing I can say with any certainty is that I'm innocent, that Jesse's innocent, Damien's innocent. I have to leave those things to, you know, the people who are trained to do that, to pursue, you know, justice and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But he may very, you're right, there's more evidence against him than against any of us.
Well,
you know, so,
and Pam...
And I agree, you know, the investigation should be opened up, and we should pursue the evidence no matter who it points to, rather than finding someone and then try to make the evidence fit them.
Definitely. And well, Pam, so she went from being she went from having a lot of rage towards you guys when she believed it to seeing the evidence emerge, or the lack of evidence more so emerge. And now she's one of your biggest supporters that I've seen.
What an amazing, courageous woman. I love her, you know. Just spent the week with her in Atlanta on the set of Devil's Night, and that was such an that is such an amazing, healing event. Everyone from the cast, from the actors to the directors, producers, everyone has put so much of their heart and soul into the story. And when Holly and I went there, and then Mara's there, and Pam is there, to see all the love poured out to her and the support, and you can just see, you know, the healing power of it. And it just amazes me, you know, how compassionate and kind and people can be, you know, who don't have to be. They don't know Pam. They don't know me. But they care. You know, they care. And I'm still trying to digest it. You know, it's still just overwhelming and amazing to me.
So you're producing the film. You're co-producing The Devil's Knot, correct?
Correct.
And what kind of led you to want to make a movie about this whole experience?
Well, for me, you know, I didn't go out trying to make a movie about it.
Well,
we were contacted. Of course, Mara Leverett, you know, has been working on this story as a journalist from practically day one, chronicling, you know, what went on in the trial and investigations and whatnot. And she sold the rights of her book to be made as a movie. And honestly, I was, you know, wasn't sure what to expect. But after reading the script and working with them, you know, to make sure certain facts are straight, because, you know, you never know facts are straight until you talk to the people involved, you know, and ironing things out and then getting involved with it. And then seeing Pam, how much, you know, it would help her and healing and keeping the memory of her son alive, and to let the state know, hey, you may have given up on finding the true killer, but the rest of the world is not. To me, that's the reason why I'm working on this film and lending my support in any way I can. Of course, I'm still trained.
Great.
I'm just like, you know, just to keep the things I know, you know, factually in line.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's important, because I think we see that a lot. A lot of this kind of dramatization of events like this, and it gets really spun out of hand.
Right.
So it's good to have the firsthand people involved.
Right.
You talked, so just to backtrack a little bit, you talked about this whole, the Alfred plea and all of this being a way for the state to save money, and that's kind of their motivation in doing this rather than just letting you walk free and admitting that they were wrong. Is that also, I noticed in the documentaries, the police inspector, the judge, a lot of the people involved seem to have made up their minds in advance that you all were guilty, and just maintained a commitment to that in defiance of logic. And that seems to be something that happens a lot. We've had a couple instances in our community in Spokane of a similar nature where, you know, wrongful death by police, and the story, they kind of have the official story and they stick to it even when proof otherwise comes out. It's kind of this thin blue line, like justice system protecting itself rather than protecting actual justice. How much of a factor do you think that attitude was in your case?
I think it was a great factor, a great, powerful factor, because you got to understand, the Westminster Police Department there was already under investigation for nefarious activity in relation to their drug task force and other matters. So they're already on the defensive. They're already practicing being closed-lipped and protecting one another. So here's honestly what I think. My girlfriend Holly thinks differently. She thinks when they had the evidence of Bojangles at the Bojangles restaurant, this man comes climbing up out of the ditch in mud and blood the very night the boys are missing, out of the very ditch they would be found in the next day. And after the police came and did blood scraping the next day, they lost that. I sincerely believe they honestly lost it. She thinks they might have thrown it away.
Mm-hmm.
But she's kind of, you know, thinking probably they might have lost it after I've been wearing on her. But I think at that point, when they lost that evidence, that's direct, real evidence that they were in a position where they can either A, say, you know what, we probably lost the only evidence that'll lead us to who committed these crimes. We're sorry. That would have been the right thing to do. But instead of doing so, they weren't strong enough to do so. They decided, you know, under the pressure, like, hey, you know, do you have a lead on the killer? You know, who's the killer? What are y'all doing? Instead of saying they lost that evidence, they said the investigation is continuing, and they made a choice to just, you know, find three teenagers, you know, Damien, Jesse, and myself, three kids who could not defend themselves and who they could paint such a horrible, untrue picture of that nobody would be, even care or be strong enough to, you know, stand up for us, and we just, you know, take the fall, and they can, you know, get this case off their hands. And step by step, you know, they solidified that in making the decisions they did. Anytime you bully a person into crying uncle, which is what they did to Jesse, bullied him into this false confession, they practically bullied him into crying uncle. They knew what he was saying wasn't true. It didn't even fit the fact, you know. They bullied Vicki Hutchison. You know, there she is. She's, you know, got some hot checks, you know, whoop-de-woo, you know. So they threatened her with the law, with taking her 8-year-old son away from her. You can't threaten a young mother with that, and she'll do anything to save her son. So, yeah, she didn't know us. So, yeah, she made up stuff to help them out, you know. And then you take a career criminal, a junkie who's on all types of drugs, and you give him the opportunity to gain his freedom. All he has to do is make up a story on someone he's never even met, who's in the news for a crime that he doesn't know if they committed it or not, you know, but he's, you know, getting the go-ahead, the green light from the state. Yeah, he's going to take that. So, you know, those are all decisions they made that were not the right decisions. And those are the things that led to our conviction. You know, that and all the satanic hoopla about Damien and us that they fed to the media, which poisoned the minds of the jury pool in the state of Arkansas. So those were all decisions they made that were not conducive to a proper investigation of finding who really committed the murders.
And how common do you think that behavior like this is in the justice system?
I'm not an expert on that. I can just speak, you know, just from what I've been through. But I've been trying to educate myself on things like that since it's happened to me. But it's too common. It's too common, man. There needs to be things. We need to, you know, expect more from our civil servants, you know, especially the vows they take, you know, to protect and serve. You know, number one is to protect. And they didn't protect Damien, Jesse, and myself, and they didn't protect, you know, Stevie, Chris's, and Michael's families and their memory by doing this.
And something that your mom actually pointed out in one of the documentaries, she's talking to a reporter, and she just says, well, you know, this wouldn't be happening to us if we had money.
That's correct.
And that was a factor, I think. And she points out again later in a different interview that they just needed to find someone to pin it on to cover their own butts. And, you know, who better than these three poor teenagers who, you know, in her words, you know, no one's going to miss except for she's like, they didn't think about their families and how we're going to fight this whole time. So what kind of role do you think that class and also race? I mean, obviously you're all Caucasian, but I think that in a lot of these cases, 181 of the 292 death row exonerees are African American, and that's a huge factor in the justice system in general. But I would argue that class, you know, is right up there too.
Definitely. Anytime you identify yourself as a group, you push other groups away or see them as less than yourself. So, you know, these officers that are in power, they saw us as a class as less than themselves and not worthy of the same protections they would give each other. And it doesn't matter whether it's race, religion, or class, or whatever. Anytime you separate yourself from everybody as humanity and give yourself a title as something and breach a solidarity and you look down on other people, then you're going to have that danger. of, you know, not protecting everyone else and not seeing everyone else human or as worthy as being human as yourself. And that's what they've done, what they did. You know, we were just, you know, trailer park street kids, street punks or whatever, you know, the case may be, but we weren't worthy of their protection.
So on a more positive note, after the first film came out and the case kind of received a little more exposure, you guys had a huge outpouring of support from both the community at large and also a lot of celebrity support. I mean, Eddie Vedder came out in support of you all.
Yeah.
Metallica donated their music for the first time, and they publicly made statements. The Dixie Chicks, all kinds of people. What kind of support did you receive while you were in prison, and what kind of a difference did that make for your experience?
Well, it made all the difference. You know, there I am sitting in prison for a crime I didn't commit. You know, initially everybody accuses me of a satanic child murderer. You know, I'm having to fight just every single day, just practically for my life. And I was beginning to make, you know, headways. You know, the people around me, you know, were beginning, you know, to say, hey, maybe, you know, you're sticking to your story, you know, and you know, getting to know me and getting to like me. So the other inmates and the staff started to like me. And then when the documentaries came out, you know, started with the staff and stuff there first, that, you know, of course, you know, they're like, they got me in there. Of course, the documentaries come out, they're going to watch it. And then they're like, you know, coming up like, you know what, I watch those documentaries, you know. Maybe you are innocent, you know. And, of course, guys started coming into prison who had watched them and you know, it's like spreading this, you know, story like, hey, you know, good to meet you. You're going to get out of here one day. And, of course, guys I was living in there with, you know, who really started getting to know me as time progressed, you know, they started praying for me and stuff. And then the letters started coming in, just letters from people, you know, all over the world, you know, saying, hey, man, I saw the documentaries. You know, I saw what happened. You got a raw deal. And whatever I can do to support and help you, gotta do. And before the documentaries were released, they were there, you know, they had to be prepared for release. And Kathy Bakken, who was in L.A. with the film industry, she was tasked with creating the cover art for it and the movie posters and stuff. So when she watched it, she gathered her friends together, and they were appalled by what had happened. And, you know, they wanted to do something. So they wrote Damien, Jesse, and myself and, you know, wanted to come visit. And so they came and visited and talked to Dan Stidham, and he told them, like, they asked Dan, they're like, you know, what's being done to help these guys? And he told them, he says, listen, if you guys in this room don't do something, no one will. So they created the WM3.org website and, you know, gave a platform for people to get together and kind of organize, you know, a front on what to do, you know, and, you know, to be able to get facts about the case and whatnot. So, literally, you know, people from all over the world were able to learn about this and were able to make aware and were able to lend their voice to, you know, making, you know, things happen. So those are the things that got me through, you know, the celebrity, you know, Eddie Vedder, Johnny Depp, everybody, their voices, you know, were the voices that, you know, made it okay for everybody else to, you know, stand up for what's right, say, hey, it's okay to stand up for something you believe in, you know, and try to make change. And it's been amazing. It's been amazing since I've been free to be able to, you know, meet a lot of these people and shake their hand and give them a hug and just look them in the eye and say, you know, thank you so much, you know, because otherwise I'd still be in there and just forgotten, you know.
So
that's what the extraordinary thing about this case is. It wasn't that, you know, three innocent teenagers were railroaded. It's that, you know, just we were lucky enough to have a documentary film crew film it and show the world, you know, how we were mistreated and how justice was mistreated. Hopefully we can find who really committed the crime sometime.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think with other cases like this, or how can people find out how to support other prisoners in general and specifically wrongfully accused prisoners?
Ways to find out. I was actually having my girlfriend Holly, we're both from Arkansas, and we got Holly was one of the first people to get in with Arkansas Take Action, which is a group that banded together in Arkansas for local support of us, you know, and getting us exonerated. There's a guy, John Harden, he is in the process of creating a foundation to do just that, you know, because how does anybody know about anybody going to prison for a crime they didn't commit when they don't have a platform to get their voices heard? So that's a big thing. It starts with family members saying, hey, my son is innocent. But a lot of times what you have is, you know, defense attorneys, they don't want the defendant speaking to the media. They don't want anybody related to the case speaking to the media. So what you have is a one-sided communication with the media, and it's done by the prosecution, and they're going to do anything they can to win the case, not necessarily to make justice happen, but to win the case, even if it means convicting innocent people. So it's very difficult to get the word out there for an innocent person. And, you know, you hear about a lot of these actual innocent cases being overturned through DNA, but not every case has DNA, mm-hmm. you know. So what about those people who don't have DNA who are innocent? You know, so it's a big deal. My thing is, you know, how can we change the way, you know, people think that are actually investigating the crime? How can we, you know, make sure that they continue to follow the evidence and do their best to find who committed the crime rather than find somebody they don't like or whatever, thinks just a big jerk or whatnot, and pin the crime on them, you know? And I sincerely think, you know, you become, as a person, as a human, you kind of become what your job is, whatever the title is. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a baker, you know, you know what you're doing. You're baking good, you know? But for prosecutors, you know, their name implies prosecution. To prosecute. Maybe if we change their title to be truth finders, they would be, you know, more predisposed to just finding the truth rather than prosecuting. Maybe we should make it, you know, easier for them if they've begun a prosecution on someone, and as the prosecution unfolds, they figure out and find evidence that this person is actually innocent, and they've, you know, made a mistake by prosecuting this person. And we should be able to make it easier for them to say, hey, you know what? We began this journey prosecuting this guy, but as the case has unfolded, I found evidence. You know what? We got the wrong person. And as a society, we should not villainize them for admitting that, you know, they've made a mistake, and mm-hmm. give them the power to drop the charges without, you know, having fear of, you know, losing their jobs and things like that. Because I think that plays a major role. You know, you have the prosecutor, he's like, dang, I've already pointed a finger at these guys. And now if I say I made a mistake, will I have a job tomorrow? Will I be able to put food on my family's table? Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these things are factors. And, you know, it's not one easy solution. It's just a paradigm shift we have to, you know, make as a society, as a people.
Mm-hmm. I think, like you said, as a whole, as a society, we really have a tendency to vilify in politics, you know, in law, in all of it. Anyone who changes their mind is kind of,
yeah, I mean, that's to, a not to tough be trusted. Job, mm-hmm. You know, that is a tough job.
So, and you now have expressed the desire to study to become a lawyer.
Correct. And hopefully, I'll be able to, you know, make the grade or whatnot.
And then, would you plan to work toward structural reform like that?
Oh, definitely. Structural reform, helping innocent people who are already in prison, you know, making it easier to be released, making it easier for, you know, the system to not convict innocent people from the beginning. There's a lot of issues, you know, I've come in contact with, you know, having grown up as an innocent person in prison that, you know, I'd love to see come to pass. Abolition of the death penalty, for one. As you know, it's human. We got a great human system. We got a great justice system. But like any system that is human driven, it's easy to make mistakes. Well, mistakes can be corrected. You know, if you take the wrong turn, you're in a city you've never been in, and you take the wrong turn on a one way street. You know, and everybody's coming by saying, "Hey, you're going the wrong way." Well, you can stop, pull over, and turn around and get going the wrong way. But mm-hmm. once you executed an innocent person, you can't bring that person back to life. That's one mistake that can't be undone, you know. And we can't run the risk of murdering an innocent person like that. And I mean, that's a terrifying prospect, you know, to put somebody through. So we need to get away from the death penalty, if for no other reason than that. You know, plus two, it is not a deterrent. You know, having the death penalty on the book is not a deterrent for people who would actually commit murders heinous enough to be put on death row. So we can throw that argument out the door too. So definitely for that. And, you know, life without parole for juvenile, that's another issue. You know, I want to see change. Because, you know, I grew up with a bunch of guys in prison, you know. A lot of those guys, you know, I could see are not ready to be released in society, but there's a lot of them that, you know, I personally would be willing to give a second chance, and I think they would do great and, you know, be a positive contributor to society at large, you know, mm-hmm. and help heal society.
And you know, I actually have
room
forgiveness
and mercy. Okay, go for it.
Oh, no, I actually have a video, a quick video I was going to play on the air that you guys sent me that has a little more detail about life without parole for juveniles. So I'm going to play that right now. It's do you happen to know who produced this video? Because there's no credits on it.
Hang on. Holly, do you know who produced the video about the life without parole?
The group is called the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth.
The Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth.
Correct.
And here it is. There's some that is in text, and I'll just read over that. Just play it real quick.
All right.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in March in two cases, which argued that sentencing a 14-year-old to life in prison without the possibility of parole is cruel and unusual punishment. Family members of victims and incarcerated youth, advocates, and others began lining up on the sidewalk the night before to make sure they could be in the courtroom for the arguments.
We're here as supporters for the petitioners in these two cases, hoping that the court will rule that it is unconstitutional to sentence children to life in prison without parole.
One of the two then juveniles who killed my daughter is still in prison, and one is already paroled and a remarkably different person.
Jason Baldwin was sentenced to life without parole as a teen.
I grew up 18 years in prison. I've seen guys completely change. At one point, you know, I knew this guy, and the way he was at this particular place and time, I would not want to see him free. But then later on, he changed, you know, became someone who cared about people, who wanted to help people.
We're saying let's look at them on a case-by-case basis, but let's not send any of them to prison forever with no hope. And say to them and their families and everyone else in our society that these kids are irredeemable.
Even if that person did something as horrendous as murder, as hard as that is to look at, as society, we have to forgive. And to forgive, we have to grant parole to these people eventually if they show remorse, if they, you know, shown that they can come back to society and play by the rules.
It will never be about saying to him it was okay. He knows even better than I do. It will never be okay. But that's not what forgiveness is in an issue like this.
The United States is the only country in the world that sentences children to life without the possibility of parole.
We know that young people are capable of committing horrible crimes and they're not excusable. The question is how we hold them accountable for the crimes they've committed.
I'm not condoning, you know, the young man who took my son's life. I want him to be punished. I want him to be held accountable. But at the same time, I recognize that we have to have, there has to be a some sort of balance.
Being a mother of, you know, of a son or a child, you know, serving life without parole has been devastating. It's been heartbreaking. My son was a loving person. You know, we close family. And then to hear about something that happened or the nature of what, you know, he was accused of, it really, it almost took me out.
I think that, you know, jail time is is in line. I then have an opportunity to become before a review board so that we can take a look at this kid's actions, his behavior, to determine whether or not, you know, they've changed their lives. And then, you know, be given the opportunity to re-enter society with the, you know, the caveat that they have to give back to that which they've taken from.
My son is doing well. He was in the 10th grade. He was 16 years old. And after his sentencing in August of 2008, he sent me a certificate, his diploma. He received his GED in February of 2009. And, you know, he started working. He was doing different things, trying to stay active. So what I've talked to my son about is just telling him, just keep the hopes and praying that, you know, someday this sentence will be abolished.
More than 29 states have imposed life without parole on children as a mandatory sentence.
I just believe that, you know, young people in particular have this unique capacity to change, and that as a society we shouldn't be punishing them for the rest of their lives based on their greatest failures, but should focus on their potential and do everything we can to ensure that they are able to live out that potential.
As a teenager, O'Shea Israel got into a fight with another boy and killed him. O'Shea has now finished serving his prison sentence for murder.
I committed a murder. I was to stand trial for possibly going to prison for the rest of my life. And thanks to the compassion of the judge, he decided he didn't want to convict a minor for the rest of his life in prison. He gave me a chance and opportunity. And I'm out here trying to make a difference, and I want to show the world that juveniles have the capacity to change.
He is not that 16-year-old boy that has taken my son's life. He is now a man. He's turning his life around, and I know it's genuine.
I can take what I've done wrong and try to make something better of myself. And for a long time, I struggled with forgiving myself as well. But then I had to even put it in perspective to say, you know, I was 16 years old. I'm 35 now. 16-year-old young man committed that act.
The young people that have been given life without parole, we need to think about them as they are our children. Give them the opportunity. If they've been worked on in the prison, they've worked on themselves, give them the opportunity to come out and prove themselves as O'Shea has done.
In June 2012, the Supreme Court abolished mandatory sentences of life without the possibility of parole for children, but there is more work to be done. Video produced by the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, as we seek just alternatives to life without parole for children, focusing on rehabilitation and reintegration into society. So that video from the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, that kind of expands on what you were just saying, Jason, about why we should abolish that punishment. What do you think? They talk about rehabilitation. What do you think, just from your experience with other juveniles and other adults who had been convicted of violent crimes, who perhaps actually committed them, unlike your situation, what types of rehabilitation do you think work?
Well, definitely education. Education is important for society, for everyone, whether a person has committed a crime or not, but especially for, you know, those guys in there. You know, juveniles, you know, when they're in prison, you know, of course, you know, they left society, so either they didn't finish high school before they committed a crime, or because they committed a crime and were arrested, you know, high school ended right there. So the opportunities for getting their, you know, high school diploma is the greatest first step. Another thing is, you know, provide them opportunities to learn trades, you know, things like this, things where they can support themselves. That's important. But beyond that, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, suffer from a lot of guilt from what they've done. They might not have right at the beginning because they didn't have a understanding for the value of life. But as they grow older and they mature, they start to realize, you know, how horrible the things they've done. And they don't understand, they don't have a way to, you know, express their sorrow, express their remorse for that, you know, to say that they're sorry. So providing opportunities for that and for, you know, this deep emotional connection. You know, in that video we just heard, some of the greatest moving things were when, you know, the parents you know, of the victims were able to forgive the kid who killed their child. You know, that is the greatest healing factor there is. And that's a great motivational force for, you know, these kids to want, you know, that, you know, they got a lot to live up to. They want to you know, prove that they're worth, you know, saving, worth reentering society. And you never know, just by them getting out and going and speaking somewhere, they might prevent someone by what they say, what they've been through, might flick a light bulb in another youth's head to where they don't go down the same road and commit a horrible crime. So you have all these lives being saved. I mean, it's amazing. But in prison, it's a harsh, all the prisons are different. Even the prisons in the Arkansas Department of Corrections are different from one another. You know, there's different opportunities at different ones. But the people who want, you know, who want a second chance, they will make the most of any opportunity granted. So anytime we can grant them opportunities to do anything to help themselves, to make themselves better, we need to do so. And it's good for society. It's not throwing away our resources. It actually is the best way to spend our resources.
So which specific campaigns are you involved in currently? And what are their goals? And who makes these decisions with regards to the types of sentences that are available to the justice system?
Which specific campaigns am I involved in currently? Definitely with the Juvenile Life Without Parole campaign. SAFE, which is, you know, put together to abolish the death penalty. And then the Safe and Justice, alternatives to abolish the death penalty here in Washington. I'm involved with several different groups. There's Gulf Regency Advocacy Center, which is GRACE. Any organization I can lend my voice to help, I do so. And I'm always encountering somebody, you know, that, you know, wants to utilize that. But, you know, I get numerous letters from the guys that I left, you know, back in the Arkansas Department of Corrections. The United States Supreme Court just ruled in Miller versus Alabama and Hobbs versus Jackson that, you know, sentencing juveniles to life without parole is unconstitutional without considering these certain factors. But it's not automatic. I've gotten letters from the guys I was in there with, and that, you know, they need to file, you know, on this act, and they need attorneys. So we need to find some way to get these guys, these kids who are in there, attorneys, so they can file on those, so they can, you know, get a chance too.
So with Safe and Just Alternatives Washington, because do you now live in Seattle? Is that correct?
Correct.
Awesome. So welcome to Washington.
Thank you. Beautiful.
Thank you. Well, I didn't make it, but, you know.
So
is that something where we would get the abolition of the death penalty on the ballot for voters? Would it be an executive decision from the governor's office? How does that whole process work?
I'm not sure exactly how that whole process works. I'm still, you know, trying to learn all of this, you know, learn my place here in this world. But whether it's through legislation and lobbying or through a court decision, you know, however it comes about would be great. There's probably better people to talk to about that than me right now.
Right, but, we'll be able to follow up, hopefully, with the event that's coming up on Saturday in Spokane. It's called Honor Life, Abolish the Death Penalty. And you'll be speaking at that event?
Correct.
All right. And what can people expect to learn about there?
They can learn how the death penalty is not a healthy thing for society, how it is not a deterrent. As you know, the people who are for the death penalty, you know, one of the arguments is that it's a deterrent for committing, you know, these horrible crimes. But in reality, it's not. For these kids or anybody else who's committing these crimes, they're not ultimately even thinking about receiving the death penalty. So it's not deterring anything. So we're gonna, you know, probably gonna learn a little bit about that, and and other things, and how alternatives can be more healthy for society. You know, as a society, if we express to all of our members that killing is wrong and cannot be accepted, and we're, as a society, not going to condone it in any way. And what that means is we're not even going to, you know, commit murder ourselves by giving the death penalty. You know, that would have a greater effect on, you know, kids and anybody growing up as part members of the society than a revenge-type killing, which is what an execution actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps. It gets away any negative emotions the person is feeling. It helps, you know, siphon those away through the healing power of, you know, caring and forgiveness. And I think, you know, it's not going to be an overnight thing, but I think as a society, our society will just get better and better as the years go by and as we, you know, put this message, you know, that we care about each other.
Mm-hmm. I would think that if we adopted something like that domestically and stopped killing killers, you know, as you've said, or innocent people in some cases, it would set us in the direction for a more peaceful society and probably end up, I would hope, calling into question our foreign policy too, you know, and waging war and killing people in other countries as well. So
yeah,
I think it could only be a good step personally.
Definitely.
So, and I know that in Spokane, we have the Peace and Justice Action League has a committee on death penalty abolition that has a lot of really active members. They brought Juan Melendez in last year, and I went to see him speak. He was also exonerated from death row. He had a pretty ridiculous situation in which he was accused of a crime he didn't commit, a violent crime, and he did not speak English, and an interpreter in Spanish was never offered to him. His lawyers didn't speak Spanish, and they put him on death row. And he was eventually exonerated, and they found that the entire time the prosecution had a taped confession of the real killer, but they were protected because they were a police informant. So that case also, you know, highlights a lot of the problems that you've talked about with informants or people brought in, false witnesses brought in to kind of sweeten their own deal within the justice system, and all of these problems that hopefully we can tackle. So
definitely.
Mm-hmm. What else? Is there anything else you'd like to add just about what work you're doing now or what people can do to kind of contribute to this cause in general?
Nothing off the top of my head right now.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. And the event coming up is Honor Life, Abolish the Death Penalty. It will be on the Saranac Building rooftop at 25 West Main in Spokane. I believe it's a free event. Is that correct?
I believe so.
I think it's a free event and open to the public, and it's Saturday afternoon in Spokane.
Can't wait.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me, sharing your story, and helping get the word out about all of these issues.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So that was Jason Baldwin of the West Memphis 3 on Praxis on Thin Air Community Radio. I wanted to share a couple other statistics that I found specifically about death row. Because of DNA evidence, which is something that we didn't have, you know, even 30 years ago to a very high degree, there have been 292 post-conviction DNA exonerations in the U.S. The first took place in 1989, so that's about when this technology caught up with the victims being able to use it. Exonerations have been won in 36 states, and like I said, there have been 292 total. These are all people who are on death row, so this doesn't include folks that were sentenced to shorter terms or time off of death row. And the numbers just become pretty staggering as you move up. So the total number of years served by these wrongfully convicted people all combined together is 3,839 years of time served while innocent. So that's something that everyone should really be mindful of just when talking about the justice system and when thinking about it. I think there's a tendency in the media and in a lot of people just to kind of have this sort of bloodlust revenge mentality where people who have committed violent crimes, like Jason was just saying, you know, rather than showing forgiveness and mercy, it's a revenge type situation, which really just contributes to a more violent society overall, I would think. Due to DNA, 142 of the true criminals, the true perpetrators in these cases have been found. So almost half of these cases were factually solved using DNA. So yay science. Let's see. Yeah, 60% of people who have been exonerated have been financially compensated in 27 states, which, I mean, that's not all of them. And I would think that that should be something that's universally sought after. If you put someone in prison wrongfully, they should be compensated in some way so that they can move on with their lives and, you know, receive a job and move on from such a bad experience. And the main causes of this is something interesting. One of the 72% of these cases, there was eyewitness misidentification. So the witnesses, I thought that they were identifying the proper person and didn't. So people are just not able, especially under pressure. They've done studies about the effects of stress and pressure on properly identifying victims and recalling information associated with crimes, just because being involved with the justice system, even on the supposed, you know, the right side of the witness, makes folks nervous. The second cause is 50% of them included unvalidated or improper forensic science. So using some of these earlier techniques, using hair samples, fiber samples, fibers were a factor in the West Memphis case that we were just discussing. They're not very conclusive means of DNA evidence, but they were still used for a long time, often with false results that were proved false later. And then the last two are what I think are the most interesting, just because they're directly perpetrated by the justice system that's supposed to be protecting and serving all people, whether they're suspected or whether they're victims. And they are false confessions and incriminating statements. That led to 27% of these death row convictions that ended up later being false. So either a confession is wrangled from someone, usually as kind of bait for a better deal, which oftentimes is then backed off on, as was the case with Jesse Miss Kelly, who was the witness that who confessed that Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin committed the crimes in West Memphis after 12 hours of police questioning. And really, his confession itself is entirely composed of leading questions that he's just assenting to. And that's a pretty common thing, unfortunately, if 27 of these cases involve false confessions. And then another 20% have to do with informants. So police informants contributing to wrongful convictions. The Innocence Project, which is a project that maintains this information online, it's innocenceproject.org, recommends that the judge instruct the jury that most informant testimony is unreliable, as it may be offered in return for deals, special treatment, or the dropping of charges. Prosecutors should also reveal any incentive the informant might receive, and all communication between prosecutors and informants should be recorded. That seems like a pretty good idea, and it's kind of shocking that it doesn't happen now. So they're just presented a witness as, this is a witness. They don't include, they're also an informant for us, and these are the rewards that they're receiving for testifying. So it's a complex issue, and there's a lot of facets. Hopefully, we can learn more about it at the event on the 21st, and hopefully this interview with Jason Baldwin today kind of gives a human face to this whole issue of wrongful conviction, flaws in our justice system, things that we're unfortunately familiar with in our own community and in other places around the country. So thanks for joining me on Praxis. Have a great Monday. Next week, I'll be doing a recap of this weekend's Washington Can Summer Leadership Conference that was mostly focused on the Affordable Care Act and kind of next steps for healthcare reform. So look forward to that next Monday, and thank you for joining me.